You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com. Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story as we pull the best interviews from the archives of the IFH Podcast Network. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind. This episode originally aired on the Make Your Movie with Dave Bullis podcast.
Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart.
Hi, everyone. Thanks again for joining me for another episode of the Dave Bullis Podcast. Joining me today is John Russo. John is the co-writer of the legendary movie Night of the Living Dead. John is also a screenwriter and film director, and he's also written several amazing books on filmmaking. He is currently funding his own project on Indiegogo called My Uncle John is a Zombie. John Russo, how are you doing, sir?
Oh, very good. Thanks, Dave.
You know, it's a pleasure to have you here, John, you know, because Night of the Living Dead is one of the most influential movies for me. You know, I watched that movie all the time as a kid, even though I probably shouldn't have because I was still young. And but I mean, I remember seeing that and thinking, wow, this is, I mean, as a young mind, you don't really appreciate all the aesthetics and everything else. You just, you know, I saw these undead, you know, people. And I'm thinking, wow, this is great. And I remember discovering around that same time, I discovered the remake that Tom Savini did. And I thought, wow, this is just like the other movie. And, I just want to tell you that because I remember watching those movies as a kid all the time. That and, of course, you know, Wes Craven's movies, and he just passed recently, just yesterday. But I just wanted to let you know about that, John. So you're responsible for some of my nightmares.
Well, good. I'm surprised to do.
So, you know, if you could, John, I always start off with the same question for everybody. So if you could, please, could you give us a little bit about your background and how you got started in filmmaking?
Well, mostly I got started in filmmaking because George Romero, Russ Steiner, and I met when we were 18 years old. George came to Pittsburgh to go to Carnegie Mellon, and on first day on campus met my longtime friend Rudy Ritchie. They were both fine arts majors, and Rudy said, when you come back, I was at West Virginia University, which was only an hour and a half. Well, yeah, about an hour and a half from Pittsburgh, and Rudy said, when you come home for Christmas break, you go meet this George Romero. So when we're supposed to be drawing the life model, he's drawing scenes from Ben-Hur. So I thought, well, that's good. And so we drove over to George's apartment, and George came out wearing a sombrero, big sombrero, bandoleros of ammunition, two pistolas, and a big black droopy mustache. And that was because another of his favorite movies at that time was Viva Zapata. And George used to like to get dressed up accordingly. So we went to a Dairy Queen. The girl slammed the window shut and wouldn't wait on us. She was scared. And we all thought that was zany and funny. So a little later, I think that same trip, Russ was in a play at Pittsburgh Playhouse, and George and Rudy and I went to that play and met Russ. So that's when George and Russ first met also. So there you go, the whole group of us. And George, all of us wanted to be actors, writers, whatever, you know. And George particularly wanted to make movies, so we all got hooked on that idea, and things just kept going from there.
You know, and that's excellent. You're able to, you know, to meet, you know, so early and gain, you know, get that working relationship going, you know, because, you know, sometimes, John, when you make movies with friends, you know, you always talk about things. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I mean, there are people who've had on the podcast before, and they always said, you know, they had a group of friends and they met in college, and they would always say like, hey, we got this great movie idea for a movie. Let's go do it. And then, you know, and their friends would be like, nah, it's took me a lot of work, you know, but it's, you know, and it's amazing though that you were able to come together and make No Living Dead.
Well, the good thing about it was that we all had the passion to do this, to mm-hmm. be writers, actors, and directors, and movie makers, and you name it. We were all heavily into the arts, and that's what we wanted to do. When we look back at it now, I mean, we're pretty amazed and gratified that we had that kind of drive. It was just, you know, and also to stick with it back in the days where movie making was really a grind and had to be done on film and you had to raise a hell of a lot of money. And today it's easy with digital production. You know, it's easy to get a picture and it's easy to edit and you can put yourself in business for a few $1,000, where we had to struggle for about 7 years to get all the necessary equipment together under one roof and studio space and everything else. And then you had to come up with $150,000 to make a movie. Now you can actually do it like they did with Blair Witch or Paranormal Activity or many, many, many movies being made that maybe don't get the fame or earn the money those films did, but nevertheless, it's an easy road to hoe, and there's really no excuse not to make a movie if that's what your ambition is.
Very true, very true, John. Especially because, you know, Blair Witch Project and Paranormal Activity, you know, things keep getting cheaper and cheaper, because Blair Witch, I think their budget was somewhere around $100,000, and Paranormal Activity, the budget was around $13,000. So it just, you know, and things keep getting cheaper, you know, and digital filmmaking keeps, you know, going by leaps and bounds.
Well, the thing with those budgets, I mean, once the film's made, then sometimes a distributor takes over and they'll do, you know, they'll do a new soundtrack, or they'll revitalize this or revitalize that, or they'll make a blow up for limited theatrical distribution or even major theatrical, and then they count that as part of the budget. But really, you know, those films were made, but there wasn't any $100,000 into Blair Witch. I mean, they went out and bought some cameras from Circuit City, and they went out in the woods with a bunch of people. There was nothing expensive about it, and all they did was scare a bunch of actors. And they didn't know what was happening, and they filmed it. And then they turned the cameras in and got their money back. So they didn't put any $100,000 into that movie. So I could make that movie on $3,000 or less. So I'm not trying to put it down. I'm just saying that's what they did, and I read all about it. So now if they're saying $100,000, that's, I don't know what they're counting into that. It might be like Night of the Living Dead, where we got it started for $6,000, 10 people putting up $600. Then we sold, got more money from other investors who paid a little more for their stock as we went along. So that was $22,000 total. Then, you know, we ran up our lab bills and our supplier bills and every other thing, and that came to about $60,000. And then by the time we, when it started making some money, we paid some bonuses and some other expenses, the premiere and everything else that came in, it came to $114,000. So it just kept building like that. But really, the movie was made on $22,000 cash and a bunch of lab bills and other bills all stacked up. And a lot of tons of sweat equity. And we owned our own, by that time, we owned our own cameras and, you know, editing and dubbing and mixing and gear and everything else. studio space, whatever. I figured out back then that if you had to pay for all that, it was really about a $250,000 movie, which today would, you know, if you had to pay for every single thing, which today might be $800,000 or a million.
Yeah, very true.
And today's dollars, so that's the way it goes. The important thing is to get out there, get off your ass, and do something.
Yeah, very true. You know, that is absolutely true, John. You know, you mentioned No Living Dead, and you made fundraising. You know, I wanted to ask, you know, where did when you and George were writing the script for this, you know, where did the seed idea come from to create this movie?
Well, it came from me. It was my idea to make the movie. We were bitching about commercial clients and how fickle they were. And when they needed a good job for inexpensively, they came to us and they got a good job. And our walls were covered with awards from places like the New York International Film Festival. I mean, literally covered with awards, silver medals, gold medals, this and that. And we were proud of our work. And then when they had bigger budgets, we would sometimes, you know, we would go up against, in those days, commercials that cost $100,000 and maybe ours cost $6,000, and we beat them in competition. So, you know, we were a really tight-knit production group right then, back then, you know, and we learned the hard way. We learned from doing. But we all were talented. I mean, that's the other thing. We were super talented, and that's pretty much proven by the fact that through all the struggles, we still have careers going. But anyway, we were George Romero and Richard Ritchie, who was Rudy's cousin and worked for one of the ad agencies that we did for sometimes. We're eating grilled provolone sandwiches and drinking beer for lunch at a bar around the corner from our studio and bitching about the clients and fickleness. And Richard said, well, why don't you do something about it? And I said, well, you know, what if we had 10 people, the six or seven of us that work at the Late Image, which was our company, and a few others, the close associates, and so 10 of us each put up $600, even if we have to borrow it from finance companies or relatives, we'd have $6,000. And if we shot 35 black and white and work printed down to 16, we could make some kind of movie, maybe a horror film that would be better than what we're seeing on Chiller Theater at late night. So George got all excited immediately, like he always got any time there was any prospect of making any kind of movie on our own. And he slammed the table and said, we're going to make a movie, bang, and all bottles and glasses went flying, and people in there stared at us. And Richard said, you're crazy. And I said, well, you want in or out? He took it dry. He had this dramatic way of posing. And he took a deep drag on a cigarette, let the smoke out slowly, and said, I'm in. That was the start of it. And we had a couple sidetracks where we thought we had actually a comic idea of space kids, space teenagers coming to Earth and hooking up with Earth kids. And now, because it was almost E.T. before there was E.T., you know, and it was in that vein because now these Earth kids were hooked up with these space kids who had things that looked like magic, you know, and they could play all kinds of pranks and wreak some havoc on this town and on the dumb sheriff that was going to be played by Sheriff Cassano. We call him Sheriff Suck. and George Cassano was going to be that sheriff later, and then when it turned into a horror film, he immediately got cast as the sheriff in what became as Night of the Living Dead. So that was it. The idea of it and of making the film, and then George and I started bashing ideas around and working on typewriters in our separate editing rooms. And I said, whatever we do, this is when we decided it had to be a horror film and had to be simpler than we couldn't show saucer landings and things like that would be too expensive. So So I said, well, whatever we do, I'm going to start in a cemetery because cemeteries are spooky and people are scared by them, even in things like Elvis Costello and Dracula. So George went away in the middle of this, and he came back after a weekend, and he had written a story. Wasn't in screenplay form, it was in story form about a girl being chased, and you know, the brother comes and they get to the cemetery and put a wreath on a grave, and the girl ends up being chased, and so on and so on. In essence, it was the beginning of what became Night of the Living Dead, except, you know, I read it and I said to George, I guess it was about 30 pages he had written. I said, you know, this has all the right twists and turns and suspense here, but, you know, who are these creatures or what is chasing the girl, because you don't say. And he said he didn't know. And I said, well, it seemed to me they could be dead people. And he said, that's good. And I said, well, but you don't say what they're after. They don't claw, they don't bite, they don't, what are they after? And he said he didn't know that either. And I said, why don't we use my flesh eating idea? Because my idea was, which I'd written a few pages of it, that the aliens come to Earth in search of human flesh, but I was avoiding the whole spaceship landing thing by having a kid run away from home, and he steps through, he's looking back over his shoulders in the woods, you know, and he steps through a pane of glass that's embedded in the Earth, and under the glass is a rotting corpse. And so these aliens, you just would discover later in the story that they like their human meat rotted, just like in the Middle Ages people would kill a goose and hang it up to rot for a few days before they ate it. So that's how they became dead people after human flesh. And I tell that story a lot now because I don't always get credit for that. And without those two ideas, you really don't have Night of the Living Dead, or you don't have the modern flesh-eating zombie or anything that came after Night of the Living Dead. So and I took all that material. I rewrote George's thing, put it in the screenplay format. And then I wrote, after, you know, we had some script discussions further with me and George and other people, and then I rewrote his part of it, and then wrote the second half of the screenplay myself. Then we went out to Rudy Ritchie's house, where we were going to, he only lived 10 minutes from Pittsburgh, so we were going to drive out there, grill some steaks, drink wine, read the script, and talk about it. George read it, said, something's missing. And he says, something's wrong with it. And he didn't say what. And he had it, here, Rudy, you read it. Rudy read it and said, there's nothing wrong with it. It's fine. So George thought for a second or two, and he said, I know what it needs. It needs another siege. And by that, he meant that there needed to be a point three quarters of the way through the film where the ghouls almost succeed in breaking into the house, but don't. And that would make some suspense and drag the plot out a little more. And then they finally break into the house and overwhelm it. So we didn't write it, we just did it. And a lot of the changes we made as we were filming, we didn't write, you know, except maybe brief notes, and then we just did it because it was a pretty complete script anyway. You know, you didn't need to really formally write some of the things we changed.
Yeah, you know, and that's a, you know, a pretty interesting story, John, because, you know, about, you know, how those ideas all came together, you know, when you were working with George and your, you know, two ideas as input, and then, you know, and you kept, you know, letting this idea evolve, to the point, you know, where it actually was a solid, you know, fully realized idea. And then you, all of a sudden, now you have the screenplay that you, you know, you worked on, and that goes through a couple evolutions, you know, and then when you, you know, you were able to actually finally make Night of the Living Dead, you know, when you were making that, you know, did you at that point think that this was going to, you know, sort of be the cultural phenomenon it ended up becoming?
No, we didn't think that. We had total belief that we were making a good film. We knew we were making a good film, especially when we started putting it together, syncing up takes and looking at them. But all the way through, we had total confidence in our ability. We were solidly behind George Romero as the director, and he was the lead guy in our company at that time. So, you know, and like I said, we were a tight-knit production unit. The main people there were Russ Striner, who did a great job producing the film, and he's also played the Johnny character. You know, they're coming to get you, Barbara. And then Gary Striner, who's Russell's brother, who was a little younger than the rest of us, but one of the best recording engineers I ever worked with, probably the best. And he just was instinctively did it without millions of dollars of equipment. He would get mixes, sound mixes that were better than the people that had the millions of dollars worth of equipment. So, and just a great person. And we all have like this sense of humor, of zeal, drive. You know, our receptionist was Jeannie Anderson. Larry Anderson worked there. He was the only one of us who didn't kick in his $600. He said we should take that same money and make a real mother of a commercial that would put us over the top in the commercial film business. But none of the rest of us wanted to do that. We always wanted to make feature films. What we ended up doing. Let's see, who did I leave out? Vince Cervinski should never be left out. He was older than the rest of us, had been through the Second World War, and what a great guy. He was a production manager, and I mean, all of us were jacks of all trades, you know, as filmmakers and many other ways. So, let's see, Gary, Vince, Russ, myself. We were the main people, and then we had some close associates like Rudy that would come in. Rudy Ritchie would come in from time to time, and, you know, Carl Hartman and Marilyn Eastman, we had worked with on commercials, and they had acted in our commercials. So we figured right away, well, let's invite them into the party because they can kick in their $600 and also act in the movie. So they became Harry and Helen Cooper. I have written The Boy in the Basement, he was a boy named Timmy. And Carl said, well, my daughter can do that. And that's how, so Timmy became Karen. And that was Kyra. So we didn't need to write that, you know, we just did it. It's now Karen instead of Timmy. Then in my version of the script, the Tom character was a 40-some-year-old cemetery caretaker, which is logical, hiding in the basement with the Coopers. They all made it down there. And then we decided that all horror films had young, you know, sexy girls, and we wanted to have that. So we made Tom younger and gave him a girlfriend, Judy Ridley. So, and we that's what we had to write. So Keith Wayne played Tom and his girlfriend Judy Ridley, who was Carl Hartman's receptionist at the time. And we were all kind of smitten with her because she was so beautiful. She's still beautiful. So then at one point, Keith was flying in from Washington, D.C. He was performing there. He was a very good singer and got a lot of gigs. And he had to fly in to do that. We needed a scene that showed empathy between the two young people, got the audience caring about them because they're going to be blown up in the truck. So we're all bummed out, exhausted, and everything else from these 18, 20-hour days. George and I are under a grape arbor at the house, and we're trying to come up with an idea for this scene. And I was greatly relieved when George wrote it. I was so punched out, I thought it was good. I guess it is pretty good in a way, but it's pretty schmaltzy if you really look at it. And, you know, remember Ace Molly, we still got that smile for me and all that stuff. Schmaltz, but it worked. So there were other things that we changed in making the film. Somebody, I don't know who, I don't think it was me, suggested bringing the brother back and having him drag his sister out at the climax of the zombie attack. And we did debated that because you could think we thought he was dead when he hit his head against that, when he gets smashed against the tombstone. But we figured that maybe the brain wouldn't be completely dead from that, and the audience would buy that he came back, you know, as a zombie. And we decided it would work, and it did. It's one of the most horrific, surprising, shocking things in the movie. So, you know.
Yeah,
and we all did many things. You know, I volunteered to be set on fire with real gasoline because I said, we're going to look dumb if none of these dead things catch on fire. And we got a yard full of Molotov cocktails. So I did the stunt, got three takes, and they're all in the movie from different angles. So, and then I was the general's driver in the Washington, D.C. scene wearing my Army uniform. I had just gotten out of the Army. And whatever it took, we did. And that's how it was. And everybody knew exactly what to do, though. That's an important point. Nobody needed to be guided or directed about hardly anything because, like I said, we were such a creative bunch and so, you know, on the same page creatively and professionally. I mean, we just knew what had to be done to make a movie. So that's, we had done hundreds of movies by then. I mean, a lot of TV commercials, industrials, but they were all very demanding things. And they all required, logistics that worked, and different kinds of logistics and different kinds of effects and different kinds of filmmaking techniques. And we had honed our skills over those years.
I remember, when I saw Nothing Dead the first time, I remember seeing, I remember the zombies catching on fire. And I about 2 or 3 years ago, I went to Pittsburgh because they were having another Living Dead festival to save the Hollywood Theater. And they Russ was there, Gary was there, and they also got Kara. They've got a few of the zombies too to come in. George Cusano was supposed to be there, but he couldn't make it. But they had everyone there, and they also had these amazing posters. And they were telling stories, and it was just great, to also hear, we're hearing right now, just all those great stories about about making this movie. For one that really made me laugh was I think her name is Maribel, or I forget her name. I'm sorry, but she actually told a story that she applied to be a zombie in the film, but she didn't know she was applying to be a zombie. She said that she saw an ad, or somebody told her that it was going to be a love story, and she went and she applied, and she's like, oh, this doesn't seem like a love story to me. This seems like something different. And I think maybe Gary or Russ told her, oh, it's going to be a horror film, and they said, do you still want to be in it? And she said, sure, and then the day of, she had to be all made up to look like a zombie.
I don't know who that was, but I was supposed to be there, but I had the flu, so that's why I wasn't there that day. I can't think who that might have been. Maybe Paula Richards.
I could have sworn she had
Paula worked for Hardman, and she was a zombie in the movie at that time. I don't any married Bell.
Yeah, I would remember
that name.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I forget her name off the top of my head.
That's okay.
But I wanted to ask, when you finally released *The Living Dead*, what was you, George, and Russ and Gary? What was your response when all of a sudden this thing just sort of took off?
Well, we were really glad and happy because we worked so much hard on it, and you never know. And Russ and I ran the world premiere. We did first class with Klieg lights, red carpets, and all the limousines and the whole thing, none of which we could afford. but we did it. And we decided, horror film or not, you know, we're giving it a first-class opening. So we had the screening at the Fulton Theater, which was a main downtown theater then, and then we had the cocktail party afterwards at the William Penn Hotel, which was a major hotel. So, and then, but everybody worked, you know, we, Russ and I sent out tons of packets of I wrote the press kit, put that together, and then we mailed those out to 40 or 50 different newspapers, radio stations, TV stations, and then Hardman and Marilyn, Carl and Marilyn worked their butts off printing 8x10 stills. Carl had taken most of the production stills, probably nearly all of them, and then they had a photo lab there in their studio, and they just printed tons of stills, and every packet went out with two or three stills at least.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
And then the shareholders, by that time, there were like 27 or almost 30 of us. And then we had posters made 8.5 by 11, passed them out to everybody, and then people told them to put them up in their offices and on telephone poles and bulletin boards and everywhere. And we got a lot of press on the movie, even from little neighborhood newspapers, whatever, all over the place. And that all helped. And then Walter Reed Organization, Continental Pictures, was the distributor, the Continental branch of Walter Reed. They didn't do much very well. But one thing they did well was their TV spots were really good and the right kind of thing. I wrote the copy for the TV spot, and they didn't use all of what I wrote, but some of the key lines they did. It's the dead against the living and a struggle for whatever. Forget right now, but a night of absolute terror, I remember that. And they got this guy who was famous for doing the Boris Karloff type voice, and he would be hired to do the voice, the narration for tons of horror films, trailers. And so they got that guy, and it was a very effective trailer. And but I think, I mean, we made it look like the greatest thing since sliced bread, and it worked. Theaters had to take out, the theater chain had to take out ads apologizing for turning people away from the drive-ins. When we drove up and down Route 51, one of the main arteries going into Pittsburgh, there used to be a lot of drive-ins on that strip. And the cars were backed up out of the drive-ins and on the Route 51, holding up traffic. So
yeah, that's amazing.
That thing in a big way, and the other thing is that the picture paid off. So, you know, it's one thing to hype a thing and get an opening crowd, but then it's another thing for that crowd to be happy with what they see. So it just took off everywhere, and, you know, we thought we were going to be rich and should have been rich, except for the ripoff that started happening immediately. And so, you know, the whole thing launched our careers. And you know, but we didn't know it was going to go on for 50 years damn near. Still, you know, it's still going. So it hasn't reached 50 yet, but the 50th anniversary is coming up, you know, in 2018. We're starting to plan some big things happening, you know, like a national tour, if not a world tour, all kinds of things, festivals and conventions and whatever is going to happen.
Yeah, that
maybe another remake.
I mean, a world tour, that would be absolutely phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Well, in 2008, for the 40th anniversary, we did a national tour, kicked off in Dallas under the auspices of the American Film Institute. We did around 12 U.S. cities, and then we did the Sitges Festival in Spain and some of the other foreign bookings for some reason. There was supposed to be 5 or 6 countries, but I don't know exactly why they didn't come through. It's pretty hard sometimes to coordinate all this stuff, but maybe for the 50th anniversary, it's going to be even bigger.
That'd be excellent. And I know It's funny I noticed, but I know Japan also. I mean, they're huge into zombies. So I know if you did a world tour, you'd have to stop in Japan at some point.
Well, we thought we were going to. Japan was one of the countries that was talked about, and I don't really know why it didn't go. Convention booker, and he was handling all the bookings then, so I'd have to ask Chris why, if he even knows why, because, a lot of times you don't find out. You deal with these bookers, and then for one reason or another, the booking doesn't come through, and that's it. So.
Okay, well, I completely understand, John. Sometimes things, obviously don't work out. But that 50th anniversary would be absolutely, phenomenal. 50th anniversary tour, would be absolutely phenomenal. Everyone still talks about that movie. Everyone still has seen that movie, at least, at some point. And obviously with your career, you ended up following, that up a few years later with Return of the Living Dead. You got to work with Dan O'Bannon and it sort of took the zombie genre. And this time, though, it was a little different because the zombies were actually talking now. I wanted to ask you. I mean, I know I'm going, pretty far from 1968 to when Return of the Living Dead comes out, but I just want to ask, did you and Dan actually, brainstorm this whole idea about, just sort of taking the zombie genre to the next level where they sort of talked and sort of moved a little faster?
No, not at all.
Okay.
We wrote, Rudy Ritchie, Russ Reiner, and I collaborated on a script for Return of the Living Dead, and it was straight horror.
Mm-hmm.
And the opening revolved around a religious cult, which there would be religious cults springing up if the dead started coming back. And they believed the dead still needed to be spiked or burned because there was always a threat that the epidemic would start all over again. And it establishes that. And it's straight, stark horror, just like Night of the Living Dead, but it's different. It deals more with the human population going to hell in a handbasket and turning against each other because of during a zombie outbreak. And then I was supposed to direct it, and most of the ideas in it were mine. We assigned Rudy to write the first draft, and I wrote a couple other drafts to take some of the things out that didn't work and fix it. At one point, Frank Sinatra was going to finance it, and then I went to Las Vegas to meet with him and his lawyer. And to make a long story short, his mother was on the way to the opening night party where we were all supposed to go, and her plane went down and she was killed. And so that deal fell through, and that was a long chain of different deals that fell through for different reasons, which was goofy to me, but it's a goofy business. So then we sold. Then Tom Fox came into the picture, and he decided, after paying a lot of option money and this and that, that he wanted to just buy the script. And by that time, we said let's just sell the script and get a lot of money and the hell with it. And I wanted to hold on a percentage of it, but Rudy and Russ didn't, which was dumb. So then. Eventually, Tom got a deal with Hemdale and Orion, or I don't know how that came about exactly, but they said straight horror is dead. You got to make it into a comedy. So they hired O'Bannon to rewrite and direct. And so he then put the comedy into it and changed the script pretty drastically. And then I novelized his script. And then it got made and became a hit. So that's the shorthand of it. There's a great documentary called More Brains, the story of Return of the Living Dead, but produced by Tony Hudson. And my part of it was filmed by my good friend Robert Lucas, who's going to co-direct My Uncle John as a Zombie. So, but I figured prominently in the opening of the documentary because I was the only one that knew all the story, all the details about these deals and ups and downs and twists and turns. And Tom Fox had died, so I was the one that knew that stuff. And I'm in the documentary a lot, telling the story in greater detail than I've told it here.
Yeah, I imagine, the documentary would go very in depth. I know we were kind of, pressed for time, obviously, on a podcast. But it's very interesting, though. I mean, having Frank Sinatra, talk about financing a zombie film, I've never actually heard that before.
I've told it a lot in different places. I was friends with the people in that organization. They liked me. They had read the Return of the Living Dead novel, and they wanted to help. And so they were really great people. So we were close friends. So the two bodyguards, Tony Nino and Joey Rizzo, they brought it to Frank. Frank, they probably told him about all the pain we were going through with the ripoffs and everything else. And so, Frank was that kind of person. But we got help from a lot of places. I mean, Paul McCartney's father-in-law and brother-in-law, the two John Eastmans, helped us at one point in the lawsuit. And the Sinatra people helped us at different points during the lawsuit. So lots of people wanted to help because they thought it was a great movie and we didn't deserve to be ripped off the way we were getting ripped off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and that would have been, if Sinatra, actually had gone through and actually financed Return of the Living Dead, that would have been, something, because that just seems, it doesn't seem like something that would be up his alley, so to speak. Because, whenever I think of Frank Sinatra, I think of the Rat Pack, But yeah, that is one of those interesting movie making stories, John. That is just phenomenal. And I will also, everyone, link to Brains on the show notes. I'll link to it on Amazon or wherever it's available, if it's available separately to be sold. You mentioned, John. You mentioned your latest movie, which is My Uncle John is a Zombie, that you're currently crowdfunding on Indiegogo. Could you tell us a little bit about that movie, please?
Yes, I'd love to. I was a guest of Kirk Hammett at his Fear Fest Evil in San Francisco, and Rob Lucas and I were both there. And while I was there, the Epix TV channel was filming a series of commercials to promote their slate of zombie pictures. This was in 2014, I think, maybe 2013. And anyway, so during the Fear Fest Evil, Kirk Hammett, by the way, for people, he's the lead guitarist of Metallica, and I've been to several of his events, and we've become friends, so what a great guy, and, what a great band. So, and Rob was always a Metallica fan, and he's a videographer for Kirk now. And so we all hooked up, and then I went over to where they had a green screen set up in one of the hotels, and they shot this 30-second commercial where I'm a zombie, and I was put into makeup by a lady who does this on television. And it was like I was telling the story of how I became a zombie. And they did one with Kane Hodder and one with Tom Savini and one with PJ Souls and I think Greg Nicotero. They did 7 or 8 of these different 30-second spots. But everybody, then I ad-libbed about a half hour's worth of material as this zombie. So by the time I got back over to the Fear Fest Evil, the producer, Mike Ruggiero, had emailed Rob and said Russo knocked it out of the park, and they thought mine was the best commercial, and it was seen by, I guess, a million or more people, and it was so, people thought it was so funny, I thought, well, I should write a full-length script, so I wrote My Uncle John is a Zombie, and the idea. And people can go and, you know, on our Indiegogo site, My Uncle John is a Zombie, and so Sci-Fi, a friend of mine, a model, she has Black Arts clothing, and she's a fire breather, an actress and model, very beautiful. So she's going to play my niece, and my nephew is going to be played by Gary Vincent. He's been in several low-budget movies, but he's also publishes some of my books, and we work together on a lot of things. So Gary plays this dumb security guard who's my nephew, and at Sci-Fi is this gorgeous fire breeder and so on, and she's the niece, and they've kept me hidden for 40 years and fed me secretly, and you know what they'd be feeding me. And now they decide to bring me out in public and campaign for zombie rights. Some people think Uncle John is a real... Uncle John retains his wit and his sense of humor because he was always such a reader and such an intellectual that he didn't lose that part of himself like most zombies do. So he's able to say clever and funny things to the news media and whatever. Some people think he's a real zombie. Some people think it's a hoax, but a lot of people buy into it, and Uncle John becomes world famous. And when he becomes world famous, there's a guy played by Chuck Corby who had the lead in my movie The Mob Boss and the Soul Singer, also available on Amazon. But Chuck's a good actor and singer. But he plays this character named Stush, who runs a zombie hunting camp secretly. And he charges people big bucks to come in and hunt down zombies that he has to create. So they kidnap Uncle John, and they're charging $100,000 to each hunter to get a chance to kill this world famous zombie, and everything builds to this great zany climax. So it's pretty funny. It's very entertaining, and it's going to be fun doing so. It's already been fun. Oh, George Cassano's also in it, playing a sheriff. We can't say that he's accused of killing a black man on purpose. But he didn't really mistake this black man for a zombie. He killed him on purpose because he's a racist redneck. But he turns out to be a good guy and helps rescue Uncle John. So those are some of the highlights, I guess. You know, but we're going to make the movie. We're just doing the crowdfunding to raise some extra money because we want to put a couple name horror stars in it, you know. So we're going to shoot in November.
Now, are you at liberty to say, like, any of the horror stars you're trying to get right now?
Well, Debbie Rashawn has expressed interest, and I just sent her the script, so I don't know if that's going to work out schedule-wise and whatever, but, you know, I've worked with Debbie on many things, and not just films, and so she's great, and she may play, there's a TV, when you first meet Uncle John, he's in the cemetery, and with Sci-Fi, and his nephew Oscar, and when Mandy Frost comes to interview them and Uncle John, and she's the first one to put him on television, and she turns out to be a villainous, you know, villain, an evil woman who wrecks the whole thing. And I kind of have that in mind for Debbie if she wants to do it. Schedule permits.
So, you know, and that's amazing, though, and especially, you know, nowadays, you know, with digital filmmaking and everything. But, you know, it's great, too, that, you know, crowdfunding has become so so democratized where everybody can, you know, post a project.
You can try anyway.
Yeah.
It's not that easy, you know.
Oh, no.
So we don't know if we'll succeed with the crowdfunding, but we appreciate any help we can get. And, you know, we aren't rich, unfortunately. I have made a lot of money, but a stockbroker got me when the planes went into the towers. So projects like this I used to fund on my own, and now I can't quite afford to do that. So I have some investors, and then we're going to do the crowdfunding.
Yeah, you know, and other people are, you know, are doing that as well, because it's almost, you know, this actually works. Crowdfunding works twofold. I mean, I agree with you, John. It's not easy. You know, the people I've had on, you know, we've talked ad nauseum about crowdfunding, everything from, you know, it's early days. Cause I mean, I did it back in 2008, you know, using sites like Indiegogo, Kickstarter, from those early days to days of, you know, where it's, to where it is today, where, you know, people launch crowdfunding campaigns and, you know, a lot of them don't succeed and, you know, they sort of go back to the drawing board and find out what didn't work. You know, and it's not easy. It's a full-time job, and it's always about getting that word out about, you know, and having a good pre-launch, about getting that email list up. I mean, I could go on and on and on, but
yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, because but you know, I mean, anyone's listening to this, I'm going to link to John's Indiegogo in the show notes. I'm going to donate to it because I think it's hilarious. And one, and two, because I'm a big fan of John Russo, so that's why I'm going to donate.
Well, certainly appreciate it. We're going to keep plugging at it. Like I say, it's not something that's not going to get made. You know, it is a movie we're going to make, and I'm looking for it. It's going to be fun. I mean, it's constantly entertaining. So, I don't know if the script's on as one of the rewards or not, but. Gary Vincent did the Indiegogo site. He also created my website. If you want people want to check that out, JohnRussoEntertainment.com. You can buy things if you want, or you can just keep up with the news. I'm going to Scarecon, by the way. My next convention is Scarecon, and that's in Verona, New York. This coming weekend. It's a really good convention. It's in a casino, so you can go there and lose all your money and not have anything left to buy. George Cassano were there. We were at the first one 3 years ago, and we made some money. You know, it wasn't real big because it was the first one, but it was big enough. And the food is fabulous at this place, but we hit a $2,000 jackpot in the casino.
Oh, wow.
That was fun.
Yeah,
I'm not guaranteeing a jackpot to everybody that goes to Scarecrow. I wish I could. It'd be one of the rewards for sure.
And I just took a look at your crowdfunding campaign on your Indiegogo, and yeah, the $20 perk does actually get you the script as well. You get a digital copy of the script. But I will link to that in the show notes, and also I will link to Scarathon as well in the show notes as well. So anybody in the area can go to the casino and you know, as John said, there's some good food, but he can't guarantee you'll hit a jackpot, or you might just lose, you might lose all your money instead.
That's a beautiful place. I mean, there's a lot to do there. It's a resort. It's not just a casino. So you can have a real good time there and meet a lot of us who are in the film, the horror film business and so on. So and it's always fun. I enjoy the conventions.
Yeah, they can really be great. I'm hoping to meet George at one of these conventions.
Which, Cassano or Romero?
Romero. I've actually met Cassano, but
well, he does quite a few. I don't know his schedule. We were at Wizard World in St. Louis. We did that one, he and I. We weren't together, but you know, our tables weren't together, but we were both there. So I can't remember. I think he's doing one of the Walking Dead, you know, the Walker Stalkers. But I'm doing let's see. Oh, I have a big, heavy schedule. I just did the Guarbecue in Richmond. I was in Chicago twice for Flashback and Wizard World. I'm really good friends with Guar, Brad Roberts, Nicole, and the whole band. They're really, really bright and gracious people. And it seemed like there's a big relationship between symbiotic relationship between horror and heavy metal, and the heavy metal people, they just think I'm great, you know, because of Night of the Living Dead and everything. And I really respect their musicianship. So I got ScareCon, then the next weekend, the Wizard World in Columbus, Ohio. That's a Bruce Campbell event. Then I have the Evan City Night of the Living Dead Festival right in Evan City in October 9th, 10th, and 11th. Down in Sacramento the next weekend. Then there are the Night Risers in Kentucky. That's October. And then I'm going to Germany for the first time in November. So, Weekend of Horrors, it's called. But all the stuff's on my website, johnrussoentertainment.com.
And I
don't know, by the way, do you know Night of the Living Dead got inducted into a classic movie Hall of Fame in California?
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago, and on my Facebook page and on the website, you can see a picture of me with the trophy.
Yeah, I actually remember reading about that. Congratulations.
Oh, thanks. That was a really nice event, too. Yeah. All of it is fun, and the great thing about it, even for aspiring filmmakers or writers, you know, you have to get these conventions. You have to network. You know, nothing happens if you stay home.
Very true. Very true, John. You know, and I want to say, you know, I know you're a busy guy, and I know you're pressed for time, and I just want to say, I'm so happy, you know, you came on this podcast. I'm happy we got to talk about Another Living Dead, Return of the Living Dead, and also your new project, My Uncle John is a Zombie, and you have to hear all these stories, and I just want to say thank you very much, and also it's you know, all your advice about, you know, about what to do, and, you know, actually going out there and doing things. I think a lot of people end up having paralysis through analysis, and they just sort of talk about making a movie rather than actually making one, if you know what I mean.
Well, writers have done that, so-called writers. have talked about their writing more than they've done it. So those kinds of people don't succeed, and they wonder why, and they get bitter, some of them, you know?
Yes.
So don't get bitter, do it. All right.
So,
okay, well, I thank you. You know, people like you help keep us going, help our careers go, and our connections with fans. So thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure, John. And I will link to everything John talked about in the show notes. So if you ever, you know, didn't worry about catching something that maybe John or I said, you know, 99.9% of everything is going to be in the show notes. And it's all clickable. So it'll automatically take you wherever you need to go. And so that's why I always remind people, John, the show notes page is so critical, because it's like a wealth of information at the, you know, of everything. It's all, you know, all categorized. It's all nice and ordered. So everyone, you know, it's very easy to navigate through. But John Russo, I want to say thank you so much, sir, and I want to wish you the best of luck with My Uncle John is a Zombie.
Thanks. That's a lot.
Have a
good day.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Do the same, John. Please stay in touch.
Okay, I will.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind at screenwritersmind.com.